Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Alex McDonald. Alex co-founded Velocity Black, a digital concierge company backed by more than $30 million in venture capital and now working with some of the world's most recognized brands. He has been angel investing for 8 years and wrote the first check into Sift, a temp recruitment marketplace that exited to Indeed in 2019. He's since been reinvesting that money into more pre-seed and seed stage companies and has also invested as an LP into a European fund. Alex, really great to have you here with me today. Welcome to the podcast.
Amazing to be here, Arish. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, but glad that we've finally made it and looking forward to getting deep into it. So look, you wrote your first angel check almost at the same time as launching your own venture, Velocity Black. What was it that attracted you to Sift back then that convinced you that you should be the first check in?
Well, look, I can give you the answer that I give most people, which would be like a deeply scientific answer with lots of analysis, a deep dive into the founders and the product at the time, but that would be slightly misleading. And if I'm honest, that's probably a narrative I created in my own head after I made the investment. The real reason I made that investment is I'd say definitely a reason why anyone should angel invest in another company is I knew Jack very well as a person. I'd actually knew Jack for about 6 years before that. We were working together as students in a bar in Bordeaux. I knew his personality. I knew how hardworking he was. I did like the idea, but the main reason I invested, that was a FOMO check. I couldn't have one of my friends, one of my best friends, start a company and see that company go on to have a big impact on the world and be really successful and not be a part of it. And my advice to anyone, if you're angel investing or just starting angel investing, if you have a friend who's starting a company and you rate them as a person, which I'm sure you do if they're your friend, you absolutely have to write a check, because you won't be able to look at yourself in the mirror if in 5 years or 10 years later, that company's had a huge impact on the world and you weren't able to play a tiny part in it. So that's the real reason I invested. but look, I did like the idea. You know, when Jack was starting Sift, and this was just before his co-founder Novo joined, at that point, they didn't really have a product. But the idea was to create a marketplace which connected temporary workers and initially focused on hospitality with restaurants and catering companies and other businesses within that sort of hospitality sphere. It was, you know, an ambitious project because the market, you know, it's a huge, $100 billion plus global market. And there weren't really any other players attempting it at the time. And the reason was is because it was very capital intensive to launch a marketplace in that space with the right level of vetting and quality for it to be a useful product, particularly for the restaurants and catering companies. So I thought it was a very ambitious idea, and certainly one that I could see 100x-ing from that first round that they were doing. And I backed Jack as a person. I'd known him for a long time, and I was actually extremely relieved when Novo joined, as they're complementary skill sets as co-founders. But if I'm brutally honest, it was really a FOMO check. I couldn't have one of my best friends start something and go on to have a big impact and not be a small part in that. So definitely a piece of advice I give to anyone starting angel investing is invest. If your friends are starting something, even if you can only put a small amount of money in, do it, because you might live to regret it if you don't.
I think there's a few things to unpack there. The first being that you may find your friends, your friendship circle starting to grow if that's the attitude you take. But joking aside, for those that don't know, Alex is talking about Jack Beeman and Novo Constare, who founded Syft and as we said, exited to Indeed in 2019. But I actually think that that's a really strong way of thinking about at least the initial stages of angel investing, where a lot of it is really about getting to grips with who the founder is, understanding them as people, especially when you're sort of investing at pre-seed, maybe at seed, where you don't really have much else to go on. So you're really backing the execution ability of those founders, right? And we're going to talk about that in a bit more detail in a second. But, you know, you did see a great exit from there, not quite the 100x that you hope, but certainly 26x the investment after only 4 years, which is an incredible result. But we all know that investing in early stage tech doesn't always end up with such great results, right? So talk us through some of the more challenging investments you've made and the lessons you've learned. You know, I'd be really interested to see, you know, exits that seemed great at the outset, but maybe haven't been quite as good as they ended up being.
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. And one mistake I certainly made in my early years of angel investing was not diversifying enough, right? So I think there are two really important things for someone to focus on when they first start angel investing. Number one is accessing the best deal flow. There is a big range in the quality of deal flow. And you realize that the very best deals, until you're connected with the right people in angel investing and venture, you just don't see unless you're connected to those people, right? So accessing high quality deal flow is the first part. And then secondly, is diversification, right? If you're going to build up a portfolio, you know, startups have a high failure rate. And, you know, I think the failure rate's still 90%, or at least that's the one that's touted by everyone. But if you build up a portfolio, a strong and varied portfolio, it's even more important to do that with private market investing with startups than it is in public markets, because you have the power law of returns where, you know, in a portfolio of, let's say, 100, you know, 3 or 4 are going to be the ones that return 50, 100x. There's probably going to be 20 or 30 that return sort of 2 to 100x, or like 2 to 20x. And then the rest, you know, probably unlikely to return anything. If not, you know, oh, well, let me start that again. Let me rephrase that. So, you know, if you're building a portfolio and you have 100 startups in it, you're probably going to have 3 or 4 which may return, you know, 50 to 100x. You're going to probably have 20 to 30 that might return a positive return on your investment. And then the rest are not going to return even the capital you invested, and most of them are likely to fail. So, and there's a lot of research out there that now shows, as long as you build a portfolio of 50 plus startups, it's very hard to lose money. Right. So when I first invested in Syft, I was thinking, OK, I'm going to invest sort of 30 to 50K a year in startups. And the biggest mistake I made was I'd pick one startup every year and invest the whole amount. Now, what I tell angel investors now and what I do now is, you know, I try and split up whatever my sort of annual budget is for startup investing and try and divide it by at least 10. So over a 5 year period, you build up a diversified portfolio. And if you do that, you are much less likely to lose money than if you only invest in one or two companies a year. In terms of my own portfolio and where things haven't gone right, you know, touch wood, I mean, I've only had, of all the startups I've invested in, I've only had one which has failed, which has not returned the capital I invested in. It was a D2C wine, consumer wine delivery company, which is an area that I don't have much knowledge of. I don't have really any knowledge of D2C businesses that are doing, you know, subscription services via mail for physical products. And I made the mistake of investing purely because I'm very passionate about wine. And so that was that's the only one that I've had which has effectively shut down. Everything else in my portfolio is still active, and you know, the vast majority have provided very good paper on paper returns, at least. but yet to materialize in cash. But so, you know, in order to avoid having a portfolio which really doesn't return you money, the real key is just diversifying. So think in your head, how much are you looking to invest in a year? Divide it by at least 10, hopefully more than that. And if you're able to put those smaller checks into companies, you'll find that you'll do better, certainly at protecting the downside. And you're more likely to have those one or two big hits which come through at sort of 100x.
Yeah. So look, I mean, I think there's a few things there that are really important to sort of tweak out a little bit, right? So first off the bat, the diversification and the power law of returns. I think the power law of returns is something that people don't understand and often get frustrated with when they think about either angel investing or venture capital, whereby they think, well, it would be much more sensible to invest in lots of businesses that are going to return, 100 million or sell for 100 million rather than trying to find the one that's going to return, you know, or sell for $1 billion. And I think the problem that people don't quite understand is to pick, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 companies that are likely to be able to exit at 100 million and also carve out an ownership stake that is significant enough that it makes a difference for you, it is very unlikely, right? So power law works by, as you say, diversifying your portfolio, swinging very, very hard for each and every business that you invest in, and trying to get to a stage where at least one or two or three of those businesses within your portfolio actually return the majority, if not all, of your capital, and everything else beyond that sort of becomes upside. One of the things that I really think was interesting was, you know, the one business that you invested in that, let's say, arguably didn't lead to success, probably still gave you a bunch of learnings, right? Because from that, you learned maybe not to invest in a product that you're passionate about, but you don't know enough about the, you know, the sector or the business model or something else, right? Because I kind of think angel investing, much like operating, is about taking lots of bets and learning from the ones that fell so that you get better at pattern recognition and selecting down the future. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think particularly if you're just starting angel investing, I think focusing on areas where you have knowledge and expertise would definitely be up there with one of my top pieces of advice. And, you know, I definitely learned a lot through that journey. And I, to be honest, I'd back that entrepreneur again. He actually did a great job. He did everything he possibly could. And it actually grew very rapidly, but it was a cash crunch, which ended up taking him out. So yeah, look, focusing on areas where you have some knowledge and expertise, not only will that lead you to hopefully having a more successful financial track record with your investing, but also it will help you be more helpful to the company and the founder itself, right? You know, to be honest with Josh and the wine list, I was pretty much unable to give him much useful advice because I hadn't been there and done that with that type of company. I hadn't invested in those types of companies before. So, focusing on your sort of your domain, your area, or at least your sphere of expertise should enable you to get better returns, and it should enable you to be a more helpful angel investor to the companies that you're investing in.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So it'd be great to kind of seg into understanding more about your actual overall approach to angel investing, right? So do you work on a thesis basis, as many VCs do, or are you less thematic? And I'm always really interested in how people's backgrounds as operators influence their investing, because I think we all have a gut feel that operators make better investors, but actually I think there is a bunch of data out there that suggests that it's not quite as simple as that. So, you know, what's your take on that? And do you think it actually has helped you become a better angel?
Yeah, 100%. It's helped me become a better angel. The main reason for that is I invest at pre-seed stage. Predominantly, occasionally I'll do seed, but I'm normally investing at pre-seed. And at that stage, the most important thing that you're assessing is the team and the founders of the business. And having been on that journey, and I'm still on it with two companies actually now, but having been on that journey, you know what it takes to get through the various different challenges and hurdles that present themselves, right? And you're in a much better place to be able to assess, are these people sitting here just starting out this journey, have they got what it takes to take this to scale and for it to have a really big impact on the world? So I think that's the main advantage it gives you broadly, right? Now, if I'm drilling into what I invest in, I really like investing in marketplaces. Now, Velocity Black, as it currently stands, isn't a marketplace business, but our first product actually, which we pivoted away from, was a marketplace business. And I had, I'd done a lot of research and speaking to lots of sort of C-level executives at large marketplace companies like OpenTable, for example, back in the day. And so I felt like I had a good understanding of how marketplaces work. Also, there's the added factor of the SIF journey and the fact that that turned out very well, which has certainly impacted, my at least where I focus my angel investing energy. That is my number one focus is certainly marketplaces. I have invested in some B2B SaaS. I have invested in some consumer startups, and I have invested, in fact, in some deep tech as well. But those are normally much smaller tickets, and it's normally where I'm, relying more on the expertise of someone I trust very closely, who's also co-investing with me. I love marketplaces. I believe I have some domain expertise and knowledge on marketplaces. And then I believe as an operator angel, I have some expertise on what it will take for these humans to get this to scale, which gives me, gives me an advantage in assessing those opportunities at the pre-seed stage. Now, as you move through the phases, you get to seed and product market fit, and you have metrics and other things which you can use to assess a company. I think, that becomes less important because you have proof points in the numbers that these people can actually execute, right? But for me, really looking and assessing the people at that pre-seed stage is the most, that's where I spend 90% of the time that I invest in sort of due diligence on these companies, is assessing the founding team.
So there's a couple of things I wouldn't mind talking through in a bit more detail. So obviously pre-seed, very early stage, often pre-product or very early product, little bit of traction, certainly not met, no real metrics of any standing. Do you find as an angel, though, you're able to get into seed and later rounds, or do you find that you're priced out? Or is it a capital kind of, is there a limit to the amount of capital that you can deploy and therefore that you can actually invest in seed or series A or series plus businesses? I think it'd be really interesting to understand that, because I think a lot of people, see deals when they get to those later stages. And this goes back to your earlier point around deal flow, right? If you can't get the deals, if you can't access the deals at those earlier stages, you get priced out at the later stages, right? So how do you think about that? And do you look at seed and series plus deals, or do you find them too difficult to invest in because you're then, potentially investing alongside quite serious institutional capital, and the only way in is maybe via syndicate or something else? Is that sort of fair, or do you have a different approach?
I do get a lot of deal flow for seed stage, and I do invest at seed, and I do get a lot of deals for series A and beyond. I personally don't invest any time in them. The main reason I think is that my advantage as an operator angel is diminished by that point in assessing those companies, right? And there's a lot of venture capital firms that I actually share deal flow with, and they share their deal flow with me, or when they're investing in something, they offer me the opportunity to co-invest. But unless it's at that very early stage, I'm typically passing. I would say I definitely have a limit in terms of the amount of capital that I'm investing on a yearly basis, right? So if I have enough high quality deal flow at pre-seed stage to satiate that limit of capital that I have on a yearly basis, I don't think there's any need for me to look at later stage deals. And I also really enjoy, I ask myself a question a lot: why are you angel investing? Like, well, why do you do it? And that's something you should think about. Because the typical answer of financial returns, I'd really question whether most people angel invest for financial returns. I don't think it's my primary motivator. I've talked a lot about it, obviously, on this podcast so far, because I think that's what a lot of people think about when they're thinking about starting angel investing. But the reason I angel invest is because I really enjoy it. I really enjoy learning about other companies. I really enjoy having an impact on those companies and being able to give them useful advice, being able to help them hire people, being able to help them fundraise in their later rounds. You know, I think companies that I've invested in, I've helped raise more than $100 million in later rounds, right, since I've invested, right? I've helped advise on exit processes. I've helped advise on very sensitive situations with shareholders and employees, very sensitive, legal situations. Not only, has that been from my own experience as an operator, but I've also learned from those situations, right, and it's helped me as an operator. So I think that's my primary motivation for angel investing. And again, that kind of feeds into why I focus on pre-seed, because that's where I can have the most impact. It's also where founders are most likely to listen to me. And as they go further on that journey, they certainly gain a lot more confidence and realize probably that some of what I'm saying is absolute nonsense. But there, that's where I can have an impact. That's where I can help the most. And that's what I enjoy the most. And I think if I was investing at Series B in some companies, my potential to have an impact on those businesses as an individual is very, very limited.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think if I think about even my own very, very small approach into angel investing, the thing that became really apparent very quickly to me is there are deals that, could well be, high returning deals, but they just don't interest me. And if they don't interest me, I find it really hard to write the check, right? It has to be something that I'm passionate about, that I really enjoy, that I can learn from, that I can also add value to, as you say, because otherwise I just feel like I'm not really participating. And I think at its core, as an angel, you want to participate in the growth of that journey. Unlike an institutional money manager or a venture capital firm, which are just that, they are money managers, right? So they are there to deploy the capital. Yes, they will help a business, but their main job is to deploy capital and seek returns on that capital for their LP base. So I think angels are just a different category altogether from institutional investors, which I think is really important. So, I mean, what advice would you actually give to people who are just getting started on their journey as angels, and where should they focus their attention and maybe their learning?
Very good question. I mean, the great thing these days is that so many people have been on this angel investing journey now for a few years, and a lot of people who've been doing it are willing to share their advice and thoughts completely for free, whether it be on podcasts like this or in blog posts online. I write a small blog focused on sort of angel investing and operating. And I share all the resources that I've learned from, whether it be, podcasts, other blogs, even video interviews with some of the most successful angel investors out there. So the resources are out there for free for you to learn if you want to get started. So that's a good sign. It's not like you have to go and pay to go to university and do a year-long course. There are also courses out there you can do, some of them for free, some of them paid. But there's a lot of great resources out there. And my Substack, which we can probably link in the episode notes, but I've put a lot of sort of resources there for people to explore and learn from. But I would also say there's only so much you can do without sort of interaction with other angels and trying to build a network of other existing angel investors will really help you. And some of the best ways to do that might be to join a syndicate. I think syndicates, whether they be on AngelList or Odin is another platform that hosts particularly a lot of European focused syndicates. Syndicates are a great way for you to not only get access to really high quality deal flow if you're joining the right syndicates, but also to interact and build a network of other angels where you can test your own hypotheses, your own assumptions, understand how they evaluate companies, and then potentially even share some deals from your own deal flow with them to get their feedback. So I think that interaction's key, and trying to connect with those people, whether it be through syndicates, whether it be through the various WhatsApp or Slack groups that there are out there all around the world, is a critical part of learning. And then you've just got to, you know, you just got to get going. You just got to start writing checks, right? Until you write the first check and commit to doing that, you know, it's very hard to actually explore or experience that journey, right? So just start reading, start listening, but then, you know, start investing, and you'll very quickly sort of hone, you know, the areas that you want to invest in, that you enjoy investing in, the stages that you enjoy investing at. And you'll also realize, you'll also come to realize why you're angel investing, right? Going back to my earlier question, that's something you should ask yourself, like, why are you angel investing at the start? And you may find that reason changes over time. At first, it may be about financial returns. Then it may be about learning about companies. Then it may be about helping other people. Then it may be about making the world a better place and trying to lift people up from underrepresented backgrounds. There may be a lot of different motivations, and you're only really going to realize which one of those is the most important after you start writing checks.
Yeah, I think that last point about writing checks is probably the most important. I did a whole bunch of reading and, you know, trying to learn, and, you know, you set up a WhatsApp group, I think, with a number of angels, which has been really helpful, but can also be overwhelming, right? And I think there are people out there that you know, really want to learn and take on as much information as they can, but I think taking on too much information can actually be counterproductive, because you will always find angels with conflicting advice. Therefore, the only person you can really learn from is yourself, which comes back to kind of writing that first check. And one of the things that I think it's really important to say here as well is, we're now in a place where those checks don't need to be super high. Like, they don't need to be 5, 10, 15, 50, 100,000 pound or dollar checks. You know, people are now investing, and I've invested, you know, as little as £1,000. And of course, through platforms like Cedars and Crowdcube and other crowdfunding sites, you can invest as little as £10, right? So there's never been a better time to kind of dip your toes and experience what it is. And I think that is really the only way you can learn. You talked a little bit about syndicates there, right? And you recently set up your own syndicate, Alchemy, and were first investor. You were the first investor in Odin, whose founder Patrick Ryan was a previous guest on the pod. And it's one of the platforms like Vauban, which is changing the way we can access and participate in deals. How do you see it changing the investment landscape? And what does it mean for angels as well as VCs deploying at those very early stages?
Yeah, great question. And in fact, referencing back to what you asked earlier around, do I have like a thesis? You know, one thesis I do have, which is applicable to a lot of the investments I'm making at the moment, is I think the last 10 years has been of investing has been defined by democratization of access to public markets. And we've seen massive growth in retail participation investing in public markets. And I think the next decade is going to be defined by that same democratizing process, but really impacting private markets or alternative investments, and startups is certainly a part of that. So that's one trend which I see really taking hold already. And there's been massive growth in both angel investing and obviously venture growth. Ventures growing, ventures are a $500 billion industry at the moment. It's growing triple digit percentages year over year, right? There is a huge interest in investing in private market companies. Now, the great thing about platforms like Odin is they're enabling new participants in that market, right? So you're having a lot of people who previously probably wouldn't have been able to meet the minimum check size that most companies are looking for as part of their fundraise, whether that's 25K, 50K. Suddenly you're able to invest through a syndicate, and perhaps from as little as $1,000, you know, as an initial check, which is great. So they're opening up angel investing to a lot of people who previously wouldn't have been able to participate in it. And also they're enabling those people to get access to the very best deals and deal flow. And, you know, going back to why I started my syndicate, I started that WhatsApp group with a number of angels, I think 4 years ago, when a lot of us had done very well out of SIFT. And we were just sharing new startup investments in that group. And I found within a couple of years, we were at the point where we were leading seed rounds together. And I thought, well, I think it's probably time we kind of formalize this somehow. So put together the syndicate structure to not only pool our money and influence as a group, but also enable a lot of new participants from different backgrounds who probably wouldn't have been able to meet the minimum ticket size of some of those other investments, get involved and participate in the venture ecosystem. That's the reason I did it. And, you know, it's great to see it having an impact and helping companies, not just with capital, but also, you know, the vast majority of participants in that syndicate are other operator angels. And so they bring a lot of expertise, a lot of knowledge to the table, and can certainly help portfolio companies accelerate after we invest.
Yeah, I think it's, again, really important to understand that by opening up the doors to more and more participants in the market, you can only hope to breed more success, right? So first of all, to those founders who haven't been able to raise cash from angels or VCs because they maybe don't know any angels or maybe don't know any VCs, which is, I would say, 99% of the population. But also to those angels that, you know, like me as an example, with two ventures of my own that I'm building, don't have much liquidity, but really want to be able to participate in the ecosystem and help others that are going through the journey. You know, I think syndicates provide a really great channel for that to happen. And the costs of participation now have dropped so significantly that I think, you know, pretty much anyone could, if they wanted to, start writing one or two or three small checks into these syndicates over time. So look, we're kind of coming close to the close, but the title of the pod is Nothing Ventured. And that's a testament to the core belief I have that there is a huge latent value potential that could be brought to bear by people who take the entrepreneurial path. So I'd like to ask you, how do you think we can unlock that potential?
That's a great question. And it's something, you know, I talk about democratization of wealth creation a lot. And, you know, I think some people are a bit tired of hearing about it, but it's something I've been passionate about for a long time. And, you know, I've tried, you know, one, I guess, charitable endeavor I've been doing for the past 12 years now is loaning money to entrepreneurs in developing countries who are starting their own businesses in Africa or parts of Asia. And I think that is a great way to help people build wealth, right? Helping them start their own companies, particularly if they're from a background where access to capital is just so hard to secure. And one thing I definitely am cognizant of is that that's never been an issue for me. And I've been very lucky and privileged to come from a background where access to capital was never something I've remotely worried about. So I think really, you know, there are three different ways I think you can help people from underprivileged or underrepresented backgrounds build their own businesses, whether that be in tech or elsewhere, right? There's a lot of amazing small businesses out there. You don't need to build a technology company. You know, I think the first part is really around education. And, you know, I think there are a lot of great companies and institutions out there that are helping or at least are leading the charge on helping educate people on entrepreneurship and starting businesses and, you know, building wealth through starting a company. The second part, I think, is around expertise and getting access to a network of mentors or people who can advise you if you've never been there before. And again, I think there's a lot of companies and organizations out there that are doing a great job of that. The third part is access to capital. And, you know, to be honest, I think that's the most important part. I think it's more important than the other two. I think, you know, there is, if you are a self-motivated and curious person, there is so much free information out there on the internet these days that you can go and learn pretty much anything for free. Wherever you are in the world right now, as long as you have access to an internet connection, you could do that. And so the real barrier then becomes access to capital, right? And so how can we get more capital into the hands of people who are very talented and are curious and have the ability to go and build something great? But their only limitation is they simply don't have the money to do it. And so that's something I've been, you know, thinking about for a long time. And very recently, as you know, we're sort of launching an endeavor to try and address that. We're setting up a charity, which is called Untapped, to focus on getting capital into the hands of young people from underprivileged or underrepresented backgrounds to go and start their own companies. And the idea is to create a prize where, you know, every year we'll have 10 to 20 winners who will each get an equity-free grant to go and start their own business. And so, yeah, like that's something new that, as you know, we're starting together. It's been a bit slow going so far because we've got so much going on, but looking forward to getting that motoring later this year. But I think it's something which can have a big impact. It's been interesting. I think one of the most interesting things about that journey so far is in all the conversations I've had with people from education, government, potential donors to that charity. So some of those conversations had a bit of pushback, right? People saying, well, you know, you can't just give money to these people without having any, having any strings attached. You have to have some education involved in it. Otherwise it's, you know, it's going to fall flat. You know, you can't just, and people genuinely trying to create barriers to preventing you giving capital to people, which I completely disagree with. And I think as long as, you know, we are correctly identifying talented people from these underrepresented backgrounds, really the only thing that is holding them back from all the research that I've seen is capital. And if we think even just within the startup ecosystem, right, in the UK, I mean, 75% of founders come from what we'd call economically advantaged backgrounds. Less than 2% of VC-backed founders in the UK come from a background where their parents relied on casual work or benefits. 80% of UK founders start their business whilst in a comfortable financial position. So, you know, a lot of these people are never going to start a business because they're never going to be in a comfortable financial position. And nearly half of UK tech CEOs come from a private school background, right? So these are all pretty big issues. So imagine, given that only 8% of the population went to private school, imagine the untapped talent that exists out there where they have, you know, they have the curiosity, the intelligence, the work ethic to do what it takes to build something successful. But they just need money to get them going. Imagine the potential unlock in terms of productivity, GDP, you know, that would come from unlocking or untapping that talent, right? So I think that's something which is really interesting, something which I've, you know, again, been passionate about for a long time. And I think with the right approach and with enough money could have a really big impact on a lot of people.
Yeah, I think the way I thought, you know, when you first talked to me about it, it was a very obvious solution in the sense that it was a no-brainer, that it was something worth pursuing. And the way I think about it is, you know, today I could risk £500 if I or my daughter or my wife or, you know, even a cousin wanted to set up, I don't know, an e-com site and needed some money for stock. I can risk that, right? £500 today, you know, is not an amount of money that I'm going to be desperate for if everything goes wrong. But for most people, it's not only the fact that they don't have the £500, but it's also the fact that if everything goes wrong, they have no recourse. They have nowhere to go. They don't have a parent's, you know, house where they could go and stay whilst they get themselves back on their feet. And they don't even have the network whereby they can ask those, you know, ask someone for that £500. And I think it is not even the fear of risk that puts people off from taking those steps. It is actually the fear of risk of failure, especially in the UK, where I think we have a very different attitude than, say, in the US, where, you know, it's very easy to fail again and again and again and get back on your feet. Whereas in the UK, I think it's quite different. I think that fear of risk of failure, not having the ability to have some element of security behind them that stops people from taking that course. So I'm very excited. We will hopefully get that off the ground over the course of the next several months. We'll definitely be looking forward to having conversations with others about that. And just before we go, Alex, I heard it. I think you just slipped it in there earlier in the conversation. You said you're working on something new. Do you want to just touch on that for our audience?
Look, it's still very early stage, but yeah, I took the decision last year to step back to be non-exec chairman at Velocity in order to start something new. It plays into, I'm not quite ready to announce it yet, but it plays into that theme that I just mentioned around the democratization of private markets. And I think that, you know, that's going to be one of the sort of biggest areas of growth over the next 10 years is going to be investment in alternative assets. You know, ultimately, I think it's Naval who said, if you're investing at the IPO or afterwards, you're at the back of the line, right? You're basically providing the gains for everyone else who invested when that company was private. There's 40% fewer private public companies today than there were only 20 years ago. So companies are waiting longer to go public. They are, in most cases, trying to seek a private sale or stay private. So there is, you know, if you really want to get good returns, it's becoming increasingly difficult to do if you're only focused on investing in public markets. So the new company I'm starting, which I'm very excited about, but is still in stealth, is going to be riding that wave and helping democratize access to private market investing to more groups of people from diverse backgrounds from all around the world. And yeah, looking forward to launching it. Probably be sort of end of Q2 that it really gets going.
Amazing. I can't wait to see more. So look, Alex, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here on the podcast. For our audience, where can they find you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you online?
Yeah, as you know, I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's probably my most active area. So I'm Alex F. Mac on Twitter. I've also got Substack under the same. So Alex F. Mac on Substack. And I'm open to cold outreach as well. Probably the best way is through my Twitter DMs. But yeah, happy to connect with everyone.
Amazing. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great having you.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Arish. Great to chat.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.